KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
So the Department of Education will be much smaller than it is today.
A long-expected executive action from President Trump, the dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education.
Today is Thursday, March 20th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, we hear from a federal prosecutor who just resigned from the Justice Department.
He told NPR it just wasn't the Department of Justice he wanted to associate with any longer.
How high do you let the water rise before you get in the boat? If it was just me, the calculus would have been different, but I have to think of my family.
Also, as sports betting on March Madness ramps up, what are the risks of gambling addiction?
The urges come out of nowhere. And the distance between you and the action is so minimal.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump has formally begun the process of closing the Department of Education. More from NPR's Alyssa Nadworny.
In a ceremony at the White House, President Trump signed the executive order aimed at shuttering the department. He was flanked by students sitting at desks with state flags. The president pointed to poor national testing as a motivator for reducing the scale and the size of the department, but said the department's, quote, useful functions would be, quote, preserved in full. The department administers federal funding for K-12 schools, Pell Grants, and student loans, and has the ability to investigate schools. At the ceremony, Trump was joined by Republican governors from Texas, Indiana, Florida, and Ohio. The move to shutter the department has been expected since early February and comes a week after the department notified nearly half of its staff that they will be laid off. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
President Trump's firing this week of two Democratic members of the Federal Trade Commission has sparked an outcry from those who say it's an abuse of power. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the matter's likely headed to the Supreme Court.
The White House says that Trump has the authority to fire whomever he wants from independent agencies such as the FTC or the National Labor Relations Board or the Merit Systems Protection Board. A 1935 Supreme Court ruling holds that presidents can only fire members of such agencies for cause. Jared Davidson from the legal advocacy group Protect Democracy says it's important that independent agencies remain above politics.
They're supposed to be working for the American people and not supposed to be working in service of any one president.
But the Trump administration has argued that limiting the president's authority over them is unconstitutional and says it's prepared to make its case at the Supreme Court. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Four states are suing the Environmental Protection Agency over its efforts to terminate $20 billion in funding that Congress earmarked for climate and clean energy projects. NPR's Michael Copley reports the states accused the EPA of violating the Constitution's separation of powers.
Lawyers for California, Maine, Illinois, and Minnesota asked a federal judge to stop the EPA from abolishing grants that Congress approved under the Inflation Reduction Act, a 2022 law signed by former President Biden. Some of the money was to be used by so-called state green banks to help pay for clean energy projects. The Democrat-led states say the EPA broke the law when it froze the funding. The EPA declined to comment. In a separate lawsuit, a federal judge earlier this week temporarily blocked the EPA from terminating about $14 billion in grant funding under the Inflation Reduction Act, saying the agency didn't appear to follow rules for canceling the agreements. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Stocks edged modestly lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 11 points. The Nasdaq fell 59 points. You're listening to NPR. Senior military officers from across Europe and elsewhere met outside London today as they look to work out plans for an international peacekeeping force for Ukraine. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer says a coalition led by Britain and France is moving into an operational phase. Still not clear as how many countries are willing to send troops or whether there'll be a permanent ceasefire. Zimbabwean Olympic swimmer Kirsty Coventry has been elected to head the International Olympic Committee. Kate Bartlett reports the two-time gold medalist is marking a whole new set of firsts.
It's a trifecta of superlatives for an IOC president. First woman, youngest person, first African. She decisively beat six male candidates for the position in the vote for the body's new president. Glass ceilings have been shattered today, she said in a speech afterwards.
As a 9-year-old girl, I did never thought that I would be standing up here one day, getting to give back to this incredible movement of ours.
41-year-old Coventry was born and raised in post-independence Zimbabwe. She went on to win 7 Olympic medals in swimming, including gold in the 200-meter backstroke in 2004 and 2008. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Sales of previously owned homes took a bigger-than-expected bump up last month following a slight easing in mortgage interest rates. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes were up 4.2% from the previous month. The national median home price continued to rise, though, up 3.8% from a year ago to $398,400. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
On a Thursday. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump has signed a long-anticipated executive action today. It officially calls for the dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education.
We want to return our students to the states where just some of the governors here are so happy about this. They want education to come back to them, to come back to the states, and they're going to do a phenomenal job.
This comes more than a week after sweeping layoffs shrank the department by nearly half. For more on what this action means, we're joined now by NPR's Corey Turner. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so what specifically is in this executive action?
Well, at this event, President Trump said he is directing the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, to take the necessary steps to try to close the department. There is nothing in this order that will completely or immediately close the department. It is largely committing to paper what Trump has been saying for years and already started last week when the department, as you just said, was cut nearly in half. It was interesting, though, at today's event, Trump rightly, I think, decried students' stagnant math and reading scores. But you could hear in that tape in the intro, Elsa, he talked about how great education would be once he returns control of schools back to states. And the problem with that is that states and local districts are already firmly in control of what and how they teach kids.
Right.
I was just rereading the 1979 law that created the department. And one of the first things it says explicitly is the responsibility for education belongs to states and local schools. What the department does is protect students' civil rights, and it provides some money to help schools educate the nation's most vulnerable students, including those living in poverty and students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Federal funding streams, by the way, that President Trump said today he would preserve even as he cuts the department itself.
Well, Corey, we know that only Congress has the power to close the Education Department, right? And between this executive action and those staff cuts that we're talking about, how much of any of this is actually legal?
I mean, I think that's the question the courts now have to answer, Elsa. At what point are staff cuts so deep that they hinder programs that are protected by law, created by Congress? So I'm going to give you one example, right? The department is responsible for managing the massive federal student loan program, right? And the White House says, in spite of all these cuts, student loans will not be touched. But NPR obtained notes from an emergency meeting last week of the department's top student loan officials, right after these cuts were announced. And their worry in this meeting was palpable. Multiple officials in that meeting said they had not been consulted about the cuts ahead of time. They had lost people they considered vital. One official even said they were worried these cuts had made the agency vulnerable to hackers trying to steal borrower data. So I think it is worth being skeptical when the Trump administration says it won't touch a certain program, because these programs don't exist without the people to implement them.
Exactly. And that's just student loans. What about K-12 schools and families? Like, what could all of this mean for them?
I mean, I think it depends on how far these cuts go. You know, that funding for vulnerable students I mentioned earlier, it requires staff to manage and distribute. More broadly, though, Elsa, I want to end on this note. The White House is making very clear this is part of an effort to expand school choice across the country, including private school choice. President Trump has been a big champion of creating a federal tax credit to help families pay for private school tuition. Mm-hmm. Democrats would certainly oppose a move like that. I think overall, we're seeing the Trump administration really try to shake the foundation of the nation's public education system right now.
That is NPR's Corey Turner. Thank you, Corey.
You're welcome.
Over the past couple of months, three separate Middle East conflicts calmed down. Not peace exactly, but the daily shooting had largely stopped in Gaza, also Yemen, and in Syria. Yet in recent days, all three have returned with a vengeance. To break this down, I want to bring in NPR's Greg Myrie, who was recently in the region. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Take this one piece at a time. Start with Gaza, the renewed Israeli offensive against Hamas. Are we back now to all-out, full-scale war?
Well, the Israeli air and ground campaign looks very similar to Israel's military operations before the ceasefire. Hamas is severely weakened, but today they were able to fire rockets at Tel Aviv for the first time in months. Now, I was in Israel when the ceasefire took effect in January, and there was this overwhelming relief on both sides. Israelis and Palestinians welcomed the halt to the fighting. Both sides were thrilled to see the release of their hostages, prisoners, and detainees. But even then, these dark clouds were on the horizon. The initial truce didn't address the very tough issues of Israeli forces fully withdrawing from Gaza or Hamas giving up control of Gaza. Neither side has budged, and now we're seeing this intense Israeli campaign. Hundreds of Palestinians dead, Palestinian civilians uprooted yet again. Even if a ceasefire is restored, like we had for the past 2 months, these larger issues remain.
Okay, let me turn you next to Yemen, where the U.S. Navy is waging daily airstrikes against the Houthis. What is the U.S. goal?
Well, President Trump wants to completely destroy the Houthis. He said on Truth Social, quote, tremendous damage has been inflicted upon the Houthi barbarians, and watch how it will get progressively worse. It's not even a fair fight and never will be. They will be completely annihilated. Now, the Houthis are, of course, outgunned, but they're also very resilient, and it's far from clear whether airstrikes alone will stop Houthi attacks on ships in the Red Sea. Here's retired U.S. Army General Joe Votel, who previously commanded U.S. forces in the Middle East.
The definition of success is about stopping attacks on shipping and ships that go through the Red Sea. I think that has to stop. The flow of commerce and navigation needs to return to its, you know, pre-October 23 levels.
The General Votel is referring there October 2023, meaning the start of the war in Gaza, right?
Right. That's right. And Votel is noting this clear link between the Gaza war and Yemen. The Houthis say they're attacking in solidarity with the Palestinians, and the Houthis did halt these attacks when the Gaza ceasefire took effect two months ago. But as that truce unraveled, tensions rose in Yemen as well, and the U.S. launched this open-ended bombing campaign last weekend.
Okay, to conflict number three on our radar, Syria. I mean, back in December, when rebels seized power, it looked, there were hopes that that long civil war was over. Why a resurgence in fighting there now?
Well, short answer, the groups that were defeated back in December have not completely gone silent. A major battle erupted a week or so ago between forces that are part of the new government and remnants loyal to the old regime of ousted dictator Bashar al-Assad. Hundreds of people were killed, many civilians along Syria's Mediterranean coast. There's sporadic fighting elsewhere, and it's raising questions about whether the new government led by the Islamist group HTS can establish full control. Right now, it's hard to tell if these are isolated spasms of violence or signs of the civil war reigniting.
The thing is, President Trump insists he does not want to be involved in endless Middle East wars. Why is he being so active in the region?
Well, the best we can tell, he seems to believe he can wrap some of these conflicts up quickly and then move on. But they all have very long history, and there's really no solid reason to believe they can be resolved in the near term. And as a quick reminder, President Obama wanted to shrink the U.S. role in the region, as did President Trump in his first term, as did President Biden. But for recent U.S. presidents, the Middle East is just like the Hotel California. They may want to check out, but they can't seem to ever leave.
Wisdom from the Eagles and NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
Video games are big business, but some of the most thought-provoking and even popular video games are made by small teams comprised of just a handful of developers. There's no way to know what the next big hit will be, but video game fans may have gotten a hint last night in San Francisco. NPR's Vincent Accavino has more.
And the winner is... Consume Me.
The $10,000 grand prize at the Independent Games Festival Awards went to a video game called Consume Me. It's a darkly funny coming-of-age story about being a girl in high school.
Did you feel fat, stupid, and ugly in high school? Because I did, and Consume Me is the video game about that.
Jenny Jiaosha was the co-director on the project. She and artist Jie Ann Lee say the game's humor is the key to telling this serious story in an approachable way.
I don't know. I feel like these two are super funny. They're like super witty. She had to get on stage and make a joke.
No one laughed. No one laughed when I asked if anyone wants to buy this for $10 million.
I think some people laughed.
Okay.
Humor was a shared theme among several of the night's winners. The audience award went to a game called The Ware Cleaner.
Meet Kyle. He's the best darn janitor at Howlin' Hugs. But Kyle has a secret.
Mason Saberwall, creative director on the project, says the game started with a ridiculous premise. What if a janitor was also a werewolf?
So we basically took that stupid, silly concept and rolled with the cute, the gore, the comedy that came from it.
Other winners included Despelote, a game about playing soccer in Ecuador's capital city, and Slot Waste, a game that depicts a disturbing factory production line. The thing that these games all have in common is that their staff is small. Game development tools are becoming cheaper and easier to use. The result is smaller teams making more ambitious games. In 2018, just over 8,000 indie games were released. In 2024, that number skyrocketed to over 16,000. And revenue for indie games on Steam, the popular video game marketplace, has nearly doubled in that same time, according to analysis firm Video Game Insights. Just after the IGF Awards came to a close, the Game Developers Choice Awards began. The awards featured games from major companies like Square Enix and Sony. But even here, at the night's big event, the grand prize winner was...
Balatro.
Balatro, an indie game developed almost entirely by just one person. Vincent Accavino, NPR News, at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Federal workers now face tough decisions that they have to make pretty quickly. Even if they're not fired, will they stay or will they go? At the Department of Justice, some longtime federal prosecutors say they are scared for the future under President Trump. And for the last several weeks, one prosecutor spoke to NPR about his own decision. Here's NPR's Tom Dreisbach.
I first talked to Sean Murphy more than a month ago. He was driving and anxious.
I mean, I've spent my career prosecuting violent criminals, transnational organized crime. Never have I felt less safe than with these defendants.
He's talking about the January 6th defendants, people charged for their role in the attack on the Capitol, which injured around 140 police officers. Murphy prosecuted dozens of those cases. He's been a prosecutor for about a decade. And on his first day in office, President Trump gave clemency to all of the rioters, even the most violent. And some were talking about revenge.
I mean, there are some posts on social media saying that prosecutors need to fry, that prosecutors need to get the rope, comments naming prosecutors directly, saying now it's your turn.
Trump calls the rioters patriots and hostages, so Murphy did not feel like the Justice Department had his back anymore. The administration was firing and demoting a lot of federal prosecutors who worked on January 6th cases. By the time we talked, Murphy had finished his January 6th work and was back prosecuting cases at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Puerto Rico. He loved his job, but could he keep it?
I seek to do justice where I can and without favor or fear of retribution. Well, I guess I've got to excise that last part now, without fear of retribution.
Murphy kept wondering, am I next?
You know, in the words of The Princess Bride, I feel a bit like what the Dread Pirate Roberts says, good night, good work, sleep tight, I likely kill you in the morning.
At the same time, he said he was asking himself another question. Do I even want to stay? Several federal prosecutors have already resigned, saying they could not ethically follow the administration's orders, like the order to dismiss the corruption case against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Murphy told me that question was weighing on him, too.
I'm sure there's a line that I won't cross if asked, and I just hope I recognize it when it's there before me.
What is that line, do you think?
I don't know.
Murphy has three kids, all in school. He needed a job. So he stayed. But over the next several weeks, things kept piling up that worried him.
The interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia repeatedly referred to his office and himself as the president's lawyers. And that we are not.
And then there's one unexpected thing that got under Sean Murphy's skin. Not because he thought it really mattered, but because it did not. An official memo about the policy on straws.
It was just so crazy to me that the Attorney General of the United States would be writing a memo about the dangers of paper straws.
Had you ever received any memo like this from a prior Attorney General?
No. I mean, 1,000 times, no.
Murphy told me that his favorite part about being a prosecutor is that your job is supposed to be about justice, following the facts. He worked for the first Trump administration, but said this time feels different.
To maintain credibility, there has to be some separation between the president and the Department of Justice, some measure of independence, and that's nearly gone.
And he realized that all those changes at the department had kind of made his decision for him.
And it just was not a Department of Justice that I any longer wanted to associate with.
Every day felt more tenuous. His coworkers were getting demoted, reassigned, and a job opportunity came up.
it became for me the question of how high do you let the water rise before you get in the boat? And if it was just me, the calculus would have been different, but I have to think of my family, and I made a choice.
Last Friday, Sean Murphy resigned from the Department of Justice. By the following Monday, he was already working at a private practice. On his way out, he wrote a resignation letter. He made fun of the order about the straws. He praised the work of the January 6th prosecution team. And he ended with something between a plea and a warning to his now former co-workers. Quote, "You serve no man." Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
And in response to this story, the Department of Justice said in a statement that they are ensuring, quote, "one tier of justice for all Americans and ending what they call the weaponization of law enforcement."
The defending NBA champions, the Boston Celtics, are set to be sold for $6.1 billion. The would-be buyers, an investor group led by venture capitalist and reported diehard fan William Chisholm. And the price tag is the highest sales price for any U.S. sports franchise. We're joined by Esteban Bustillos of GBH in Boston. Hi there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Were we expecting this sale?
Yeah, so the current majority owners, the Grosbeck family, they had announced their intention to sell the team last year. Now, four prospective buyers had recently been reported on, including Chisholm, but now it's official, and all that really remains is the approval from the NBA Board of Governors. And current co-owner Whit Grosbeck is slated to remain team governor and oversee operations through the 2027-28 NBA season.
Circle back to that price tag, $6.1 billion. Yeah. How did we get quite there?
Right, so obviously it's a lot of money. Now, Andrew Zimbalist, an economist at Smith College, points out that the Celtics are maybe the premier NBA franchise. Sorry, Lakers. And while the NBA has stayed steady with 30 teams since 2004, outside factors like population and incomes in the U.S. have grown, which has helped to make franchises more valuable.
So all these sources of revenue and demand for top-level professional basketball in the United States, all those sources have grown at the same time that the supply of franchises has stayed steady.
Now, we said the last remaining item is this all has to be approved by the NBA. Is that likely?
Yeah, it seems at least fairly likely. Victor Matheson, an economist at the College of the Holy Cross, says the only concern is if the source of the finances is not nearly as stable as it appears, but otherwise he imagines this will be smooth sailing for the new guys.
So the NBA will do some due diligence about whether, this ownership group really does have the financial capacity to run a Celtics team in the way the NBA wants a Celtics team to run.
Well, that prompts a last question, Esteban. Are the new owners expected to bring new ideas? Any changes you're watching for at the organization?
Yeah. I think it's going to be a gradual transition. Now, the C's, obviously, they have a championship caliber franchise. The real question is, will the new ownership be willing to continue to spend money on a roster that is expected to be the most expensive in NBA history by next season?
That is Esteban Bustillos of GBH News in Boston. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
This is NPR News.
Americans say they're more and more worried about bird flu as the virus has spread to some humans. But new research suggests that defenses built up from past flu seasons may help protect us against bird flu.
While this is a bit of a silver lining, this does not mean that we should all feel like we're safe.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Scientists at Stanford noticed that when water breaks into droplets, like the spray of a hose, those droplets become charged.
Water is something that people have studied for, you know, a long time. And you might think, well, everything about water is known. Well, no.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. A federal judge says the government provided a, quote, woefully insufficient response to his orders in a case over the Alien Enemies Act. NPR's Amina Bustillo says Judge James Boasberg has been asking for additional details about last weekend's flights that deported hundreds of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador.
Boasberg had issued an emergency order to temporarily block President Trump's use of the wartime authority known as the Alien Enemies Act to quickly deport people. But some planes carrying hundreds of people still flew to El Salvador. Boasberg is seeking details about the government's compliance with his order. In a filing, a regional immigration and customs official said that cabinet secretaries are considering whether to refuse to provide evidence in the court case on grounds that it's information that could harm national security or foreign relations. Boasberg ordered the government to explain by 10 a.m. on Friday any discussions regarding this matter, known as invoking the privilege of state secrets, and to decide whether to invoke such privilege by March 25th. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News.
The Pentagon has restored some of the pages on its websites that were removed as part of the Trump administration's efforts to erase diversity, equity, and inclusion material, but it's still unclear how much of the material, highlighting the military service of women and Black, Japanese, and Native Americans, was restored. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
They have keywords to search, let's say gender or African American or Hispanic. So some of this was taken down to review it. And then they decided it took a while to do because it's, you know, labor intensive. So many people were noticing, well, where's Jackie Robinson, Tuskegee Airmen? Well, what have you done with Navajo code talkers? And then the explanation was, we're not going to completely eliminate those or take those down. We're going to put them back after we review it.
This is NPR. Syria's new government held a meeting with Kurdish commanders to try and merge them into the Syrian military. It's a key step toward unifying the country under one government. NPR's Lauren Frayer has the story.
U.S.-backed Kurdish rebels largely control Syria's breadbasket in the country's northeast, as well as its borders there with Iraq and Turkey and lucrative oil fields nearby. Those rebels had been fighting against various other Syrian factions. But after President Bashar al-Assad's ouster, the new government here, about a week ago, signed a landmark peace deal with the Kurds. It's a key step toward bringing all of Syria's armed factions under the same Syrian military. That has proven less successful, though, on Syria's coast, where this month there have been what human rights observers call massacres of other Syrian minorities. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Damascus.
The northern European country of Finland is ranked as the happiest country in the world for the eighth year in a row. Afghanistan is once again ranked as the unhappiest country in the world, with many Afghan women saying their lives are especially difficult. At least 14 Western countries made the annual top 20 list on the World Happiness Report. The U.S. is not one of them, falling to the lowest level ever in the survey, 24th. Stocks finished lower on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Gambling is more accessible than ever before. And as the NCAA basketball tournament heats up, experts warn that the risks of gambling addiction are not widely understood. NPR's Katie O'Riddle reports.
In recent years, online gambling platforms have proliferated.
On your phone, like, money's not real money. It's not tangible. And so you lose sight of, like, the fact that you've just gambled away, like, all this real money.
This woman asked, we just use her first name, Jen, for this story. She is more than $100,000 in debt after struggling for years with problem gambling. She's in recovery now and fears for her professional reputation if she speaks openly. She says online platforms that facilitate sports and other betting feel like video games. They put the casino in your house and in your hand 24 hours a day.
And I could wake up in the middle of the night and gamble. I could do it from bed. Like, it's just so easy.
Jen has also struggled with a substance use disorder. She says the primary difference for her between that and gambling is worse.
The urges come out of nowhere, and the distance between you and the action is so minimal. I don't have to call up a shady dealer and, like, ask him to deliver something. I don't have to ingest anything. Like, it's really just a matter of, like, picking up my phone.
The entire industry of gambling in America changed radically in 2018. That's when the Supreme Court deregulated it. Now, 38 states have legal gambling. The industry reports annual profits over $70 billion. Experts say addiction research has just not kept up with these changes. Michelle Malkin is director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University.
The last time a large national study was really accepted as the prevalence rate was in 1999, which is nothing close to what we see happening in the United States or the world today.
That study pinned the number of problem gamblers at less than 1%. Malkin is working to update this figure. She believes it is significantly higher.
Now, the medical community has been able to show through their research that gambling impacts a person very much like putting a substance into your body.
Neuroscience shows that gambling triggers the same pathways that addictive substances do and delivers that same kind of dopamine hit. Les Bernal runs an advocacy group called Stop Predatory Gambling.
The business model is based on addiction.
Bernal points to an investigation from the Wall Street Journal that showed that 70% of the profits from one online gambling company came from less than 1% of the users. He says with the states partnering with this industry, it sets up an inherent conflict of interest.
Those are the business practices that make all the money for the state. So there's no revenue without the addicted gambler.
Representatives from the industry point out that states do set aside money from gambling revenue for treatment and intervention. Joe Maloney is with the American Gaming Association.
$130 million goes to problem gambling services, preventions, and treatments.
He says problem gamblers can also turn to illegal gambling. Keeping it legal offers a way to fund treatment.
Let's generate revenues that can go back into cities and communities and states for critical priorities that we deem important.
There's also guardrails that companies use, like forced breaks or cutting people off after too much time. Jen, the woman with more than $100,000 of debt, says none of these things made a difference for her. She's still working on putting her life back together.
My last relapse was in December, less than 3 months ago.
She says modern life is almost impossible without a phone, but that's where the danger lies.
I don't trust myself.
Doesn't trust herself, she says, when her addiction can be fed with just a few taps on her phone. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Even though we can't remember anything from our infancy, there's new research that suggests babies may actually form memories. But they aren't exactly the easiest study subjects to work with. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
Tristan Yates has no doubt about her first memory, even if it is a little fuzzy.
I was about 3 and a half in Callaway Gardens in Georgia, just running around with my twin sister trying to pick up Easter eggs.
So you don't have any memories before that?
Oh, no, no.
The amnesia of our babyhood, it's kind of the rule, says Yates, who's a cognitive neuroscientist at Columbia University.
We have memories from what happened earlier today and memories from what happened earlier last week and even from a few years ago, but all of us lack memories from our infancy.
Is that because we don't make memories when we're babies, or is there another explanation? It's a puzzle that could reveal something crucial about our early development, says Nick Turk-Brown, a cognitive neuroscientist at Yale.
What happens in your brain in the first 2 years of life is magnificent. That's the period of by far the greatest plasticity. And that lays the foundation for everything you know and do for the rest of your life.
But to figure out what a baby remembers, if it remembers anything at all, has been hard. That's because one of the best ways to look deep in the brain is with an fMRI machine. But try to get a baby to cooperate with that.
Infants, in many ways, are the worst possible, subject population. They don't understand instructions. You can't move a millimeter. And also, they have really short attention spans. So we had to adapt.
Turk-Brown and his colleagues have spent nearly a decade figuring out how to do fMRI research on babies, and they've come up with all sorts of tricks to keep them happy and engaged. They nestle the infant in bedding, their parent is always in the room with them, and the tasks required of them are short.
I've given babies a bottle during these scans. It's the only way to be able to ask what's going on in the infant's mind, despite not being able to ask them questions. You can look at their brain, and their brain has the answers.
Here's how this particular experiment went down.
If I could share my screen, I could actually show you a video of what... Yeah, let me grab that.
Tristan Yates calls up a video that babies were shown inside the fMRI. One image at a time appears, then disappears. Images they've never seen before. A canyon, a dog toy, a woman's face.
And about a minute later, we show them one image they just saw, alongside a different image from the same category.
So the canyon, say, alongside a waterfall. Now, if the baby remembered seeing the familiar canyon from earlier, it'll look longer at it than at the waterfall.
It's as if you're still learning about it, so you're looking at it more.
So this task told the researchers which images a baby remembered and which they didn't. All the while, the fMRI was snapping pictures of the baby's brain, including its hippocampus.
The hippocampus is a region that we know is super important for memory in adults.
Here's what those scans revealed. Starting at only about 12 months of age, the more activity there was in the baby's hippocampus when seeing an image for the first time, the more likely they were to remember that image later.
What we're able to conclude is that the hippocampus can encode individual memories, even in human infants.
The results are published in the journal Science. Flavio Donato is a neurobiologist at the University of Basel who wasn't involved in the research. He says it's worth considering how much of an impact these early memories may have, good or bad.
It's an important question, just how traumatic events might lead to memories that might persist for a long time and might even influence the way in which this person will develop.
There's still a lot to figure out, though. Just how durable are these infant memories? And if they do last, are they forever off limits? Or might we, one day, somehow gain access to those earliest of memories? For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Washington, D.C. police were in an awkward position during this week's standoff between the U.S. Institute of Peace and staffers with the Trump administration and Elon Musk's Doge service. Those staffers took over the building to install a new president of the congressionally funded think tank. The police ultimately sided with Doge. How did they arrive at that decision? NPR's Meg Anderson has more.
George Moose was running the U.S. Institute of Peace, which helps prevent conflicts abroad, until Monday when
D.C. police showed up at my office and said, it's time for you to go.
That's Moose talking to reporters on the steps of the Institute that day. Institute employees say they called the Metropolitan Police Department that afternoon. At 4 p.m., Doge and Trump staffers were still trying to enter the building. According to an MPD statement, that's when the acting U.S. Attorney for D.C., Ed Martin, stepped in. He's the district's main prosecutor. He was appointed by the president and is widely regarded as a Trump loyalist. MPD says Martin directed them to a letter saying Moose had been replaced. With that letter in hand, the police asked Moose to leave. Vanessa Batters Thompson, who runs the D.C. Appleseed Center for Law and Justice, says at that moment, officers were probably right.
Metropolitan police did what they were trained to do.
Police often have to settle disputes in the moment, for instance, in a fight between a landlord and a tenant. Doge and the White House point to that letter as their justification, saying Moose acted unlawfully by refusing to comply.
I think the genuine question here is whether the letter regarding the firing of George Moose was a legal, valid document.
The Institute, for its part, has sued the Trump administration. It's an independent nonprofit established by Congress, and it says the administration did not follow the proper steps to remove its leadership. Others agree. Democratic Congressman Don Beyer called Doge's actions an illegal power grab and said it weaponized law enforcement. It also muddles the question of who police should answer to. That's according to Rosa Brooks, a law professor at Georgetown University. She has also been an MPD reserve officer.
For the first time in a very, very long time, street-level police officers have to ask themselves whether they're being told to do something that is itself lawful, and that's not normally something.
This put officers in a especially in D.C., which is tied closely to the federal government.
I don't think they can fully trust the politically appointed people who are giving them direction, which places them in a really impossible position.
She says that question is hovering over the heads of police officers in the district in a more vivid way than ever before. On Wednesday, a judge denied a request by the Institute to stop the takeover, saying it was difficult to determine whether the Trump administration's actions were lawful. The judge said a fundamental question remains as to whether USIP is an independent agency or part of the executive branch. Nevertheless, the judge added that the involvement of law enforcement was, quote, deeply troubling. NPR reached out to U.S. Attorney Martin and Doge for this story. They did not respond to our request for an interview. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Time now for our Science News Roundup from Shortwave. That is NPR Science Podcast. I'm joined by two of the show's reporters, Regina Barber and Burley McCoy. Howdy, you two.
Hey.
Hey.
So thank you once again for bringing us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
The accuracy of TikTok videos about ADHD.
How life may have come from little bits of lightning.
And why neuroscientists are studying parakeets to understand human speech.
Wow, I can't wait. Okay, let's tackle them in order, which means we're starting with ADHD, so attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I mean, I'll start by asking, is that actually a common topic of discussion on TikTok?
Yeah, it's super common. So here's just a little sampling of what you might hear.
For those of you who have ADHD, who is your favorite?
Five less well-known ADHD behaviors with doodles. Let's go. Number one.
ADHD behaviors you didn't know about, part two.
Yeah, and researchers wanted to take a closer look at some of these videos to see how accurate they were.
And how did they go about doing that?
So they had clinical psychologists rate the 100 most popular ADHD videos at the time on accuracy, and they found less than half of the claims made in these videos aligned with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM. This is a tool that mental health experts use to help diagnose and treat their patients.
Yeah, and none of the videos got a perfect score from clinicians. Many lack nuance, like just because you listen to a song on repeat or you forget to text your friend back does not necessarily mean you have ADHD. It could be a lot of things like stress or sleep issues or a learning disability.
Sure. So what is the concern here? Is it that people are going to these videos, going to TikTok, trying to get real information about their mental health and finding stuff that is not necessarily actual real information?
Yeah, well, the researchers also looked at how accurate young adults with and without ADHD perceived these videos to be. And even though they gave the less accurate videos correspondingly lower ratings, they still believed the content in the video was more accurate than the clinicians said it was. So the researchers published the details this week in the journal PLOS ONE, and the lead author, Vasilia Karasava, she's from the University of British Columbia, said this can be problematic.
It can create tension between the healthcare professionals and the people who come in for help.
She says that if people are adamant they have ADHD based on these videos, it could prevent them from getting the help they need, since these symptoms could be rooted in, say, depression or anxiety.
What is the guidance then for people who have been going to TikTok for mental health advice?
Well, first she says see a therapist if you can. A lot of times people are going to TikTok because it's easy, free, and it builds community. She also cautions against watching too much TikTok because her team also found that people who consumed more TikTok are more likely to feel worse about their own symptoms. And she says check the credentials of the TikTokers who are sharing medical advice.
Check the credentials. Excellent advice for all kinds of things. Okay,
yes.
Next topic, let's talk about lightning creating life.
Yeah, so a recent study in the journal Science Advances gives new life to like an old hypothesis on how life was created on Earth with a spark of lightning. It's based on the Miller-Urey experiment from the 1950s. In this experiment, Stanley Miller and Harold Urey tried to recreate like a mini version of our atmosphere in a glass bulb. And this had hydrogen, methane, and ammonia, and water vapor. And then they shot sparks into that mixture. And over time, chemical reactions created some of the building blocks of life, like amino acids.
But there are problems with this hypothesis.
Cue moody music. Okay, what are the problems with the hypothesis?
Well, lightning is intermittent and unpredictable, and the atmosphere is really, really big. So all of those new amino acids created could have just dissipated.
Okay, so let's bring in the new study, which weighs in here, I'm guessing.
Yeah, totally. So scientists at Stanford noticed that when water breaks into droplets, like the spray of a hose or a crashing wave, those droplets become charged. You get bigger droplets that are positively charged and smaller ones that are negatively charged. And this difference in charge can result in a spark that lead researcher Richard Zare coined as micro lightning.
It's the first time that anybody's reported luminescence from water droplets. You know, water is something that people have studied for, you know, a long time. And you might think, well, everything about water is known. Well, no.
So microlightning is a spin on that old Miller-Urey experiment that demonstrates a kind of lightning could be partially responsible for the beginnings of life.
I hear the emphasis on could be partially responsible. Sounds like we still got a ways to go before we get a definitive answer about how life first came to be here on Earth.
Yeah, we do want to stress that there are other hypotheses that could have contributed to the origins of life on Earth, maybe more than microlightning. Some scientists think asteroid strikes or hydrothermal vents played a role. Plus, nobody knows the exact combo of gases in the early atmosphere. So how life began on Earth is still a very highly debated question.
Third item, and I'm not going to lie, I have been looking forward to this one. The final story, why are neuroscientists studying parakeets?
So researchers have been trying to find an animal model they can use to study human speech because millions of Americans have some kind of communication disorder, be it difficulty producing words or planning out sentences in the brain. And a new study in the journal Nature says parakeets, that's a type of parrot, could help highlight what happens when these systems break down.
I am already learning because I will confess I did not know parakeets were a type of parrot.
Yes.
Are we talking, I don't know, like polywanna cracker type stuff?
Okay, not quite. The parakeets roamed around these like little arenas doing their usual squawks and chirps like this. And as the parakeets squawked, the scientists recorded the bird's brain activity.
One of the study authors at NYU Langone Health, neuroscientist Michael Long, said one of the big questions was whether a parakeet's brain had any similarities to humans when it came to the production of sound.
And the answer resoundingly was it looked more like the kinds of circuits that we use in order to produce flexible speech.
More like the kinds of brain circuits we use. What are the similarities between my brain and a parrot brain?
Yeah, so for parakeets, there seems to be brain cells that represent different vowel sounds and brain cells that represent different consonant sounds. And that's sort of how it works in humans. And they found that the activity in the parrot's brains while they were making sounds was more similar to what happens when humans make sounds than it was to the other bird they looked at, zebra finches.
Hmm. So how useful a model might this be for studying human speech?
We talked to a neurogeneticist in the field who wasn't involved in the work, Eric Jarvis. He was excited about the paper and says it helps move us closer to finding the most useful model for human speech. He did say spoken language exists on a spectrum, though.
Spoken language is a continuum. The parrot species they looked at is further along that continuum, closer to humans, than zebra finches are. But it's not like these principles are absent in the zebra finch.
Which means future research may find another bird with a brain even more similar to humans. But again, this is a great step toward better understanding human speech.
Absolutely fascinating. That is Burley McCoy and Regina Barber from NPR Science Podcast Shortwave, which you can follow for new discoveries and everyday mysteries and the science behind the headlines. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsored Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. And from the John D. and Catherine...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Swing high, swing low, swing to and fro, not fast, not slow. A little swing can do more than anything else for you. Swing out, swing in, it's not a sin, so let's begin. never gets the gate if your swinging is up today. When your one and only complains.